Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What mark did the Kennedy assassination leave on the Secret Service agents on whose watch the president was shot? And how many other people in Dallas on that sad day have wondered if the president would still be alive if they had done something different? Jim Lehrer was assigned to cover the Kennedys' 1963 visit by the Dallas Times-Herald. He saw the president and first lady arrive at Love Field, but rather than witnessing their scheduled departure, he was diverted first to Parkland Hospital after the shooting and later to Dallas Police Headquarters. Lehrer's memories of that weekend's events have remained vivid in his mind, along with the what-if questions that inspired his latest novel called Top Down. The book uses historical facts as a jumping-off point for a fictional exploration of the invisible wounds left on so many people by the assassination. Jim Lehrer worked for more than 40 years in public television, first on KERA's Newsroom and later as the longtime anchor and executive editor of the PBS NewsHour. Top Down is his 21st novel. Jim, welcome back to Think.
Hey, Chris. Delighted to be here. Thank you.
So you have been through this story. You have told your part of the story so many times. People are still interested. What made you want to explore the story you knew so well from reporting and from being an eyewitness from the lens of fiction?
Well, the story has been with me for 50 years, and but it was only in recent years that I really became as aware as I should have been about what PTSD and the awful impact that trauma can have on people. And I centered on my thoughts about this. There were 50, 60 Secret Service agents that involved in the entire Texas trip. It wasn't just to Dallas. Right. You know, they started in Houston. They were going to come to Austin. They went to Fort Worth, then they came to Dallas, and they were going to go on to Austin. So there were agents from Washington and agents in each one of these cities, including Dallas, that were all involved in the visit. And I had been the federal reporter at the time of the assassination, so I knew a lot of Secret Service agents. They don't, the Secret Service agents who are work in field offices, they deal with counterfeit cases, stolen federal check cases, and that sort of thing. And presidential protection is something they do rarely because they're used when there is at that time they didn't even do protection of candidates. They only did presidents and vice presidents. So, but anyhow, I knew these guys, and they were all guys at that point in time. And there were some stories that stuck with me. And as I say, time went on, I understood that about what trauma can do in combat. But in the military. But it's only been in recent years that people have come to grips with what trauma of a law enforcement officer can be. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean necessarily that you accidentally or intentionally shot somebody and you have to live with it. It's just being there, just seeing something, witnessing something, being part of a process that was traumatic can have an effect. And everybody's affected differently. And I began to think about it, and I knew of this one story that I was personally involved in as a reporter, and it stuck in my craw, and I decided to do some exploration, which I did do, some research specifically about those Secret Service agents, what happened to some of them, what didn't happen to some of them, and I was not surprised to find that there was an across-the-board traumatic experience for those people, and those agents, none of them, there was no discussion about treatment or any of that sort of thing. Some of them had serious depression problems. Some of them had serious drinking problems. Some of them took their lives. All of that under the cover of nothing. In other words, nobody ever did a story about any of them because none of them ever talked about it. They didn't even talk about it among themselves, it turned out. And that's where it all came from, Chris. Long answer, but that's where it all came from.
That's a good answer. What is the difference between the search for truth that journalists engage in and the search for the kind of truth that novelists deal with?
Well, you put your finger on something that means a lot to me. I've always said, I've been in journalism 50 years, beginning it writing obits for the Dallas Morning News for over 50 years. I've always said that journalism is not really about the truth business. It's not about trying to find the truth. What it is gathering the facts So then somebody else can determine what the truth is. In other words, what the reader or the listener, the consumer of journalism, can then decide what the truth is. You get this view, you get that view, you get this, you put them all together. And to declare, now here is the truth, that is not necessarily the job of journalism. And I know it's a fine point, oh, if you're not looking for the truth, then what are you looking for? Well, I'm looking for the facts. And I may have all the facts but not have a prayer as to what the truth is. The facts may be so up to individuals to take to look at that particular set of facts, through the prism, their own prism, that that's how they determine what the truth is. And William Sidney Porter, O. Henry, was a reporter, journalist in Austin. In fact, Austin and San Antonio. And then he stole some money from a bank, and he ended up in prison. When he came out, he decided, I'm not going to do journalism anymore. I'm going to write fiction. Somebody said, well, what's the deal? He said, well, I discovered that the only place you can tell the real truth is in fiction, not in journalism. And because truth is defined in fiction is what's in the mind, what's in the soul, what's in the heart. It's really hard to do in journalism. It's not the job of a journalist to explore the inner thinking of somebody or whatever. It's to explore what they did and what they didn't do. And so there's some truth in that, end quote. I've been fortunate that I've been in both lines of that work. I spent a career in journalism where it was fact finding, and I spent a career, and I'm still doing it, writing fiction, which is truth finding.
So, Jim, I liked the book very much, and I expected to like it very much, having read your work before. I'll confess, I hesitated to read it at first because I feared, knowing that we have multiple other shows about the assassination coming up in the next few weeks, I feared picking up a fact that maybe was not accurate. And then I read an essay that you wrote that actually says that you were incredibly scrupulous about making sure that everything you put in there that is directly related to the facts of the assassination is accurate, and that you, in a way that seems incredibly humble to me, went back and researched things that you believed you remembered accurately from seeing them yourself.
Exactly, and discovered in the process, Chris, that, and going back many years later, that I proved the point to myself that what you see is not necessarily the thing, that everybody doesn't see everything the same way. Mm-hmm. You know, you can line up 15 people, show them one thing, you'll get 15 different versions of what happened. We all know
And they're
that.
Not lying, necessarily.
No, they're not lying. And I learned from the early days of as being a newspaper reporter that the least reliable source is an eyewitness. In terms of you get the eyewitness account. But don't ever get caught in the trap. Say, well, now here's what happened because I talked to Billy Bob and Billy Bob saw this. Well, all you have is what Billy Bob saw, and I've learned that so many times. I've also covered the criminal courts in Dallas County, and where there'd be five or six eyewitnesses to a crime. And in many of the cases I covered, they were death penalty cases. They were sending people to Huntsville to the electric chair every 3 days in those days. And it was all dependent on what somebody saw and didn't see. Well, I didn't quite see it that way. It was raining. No, it wasn't raining. Well, when I came back, get to the point, when I came back and looked at the facts of the Kennedy assassination that I personally observed and then went back to see what really actually happened, thinking that I would, just to make sure that my facts were right from my memory. My facts were not right from my memory. And just small things. Mm-hmm. I had written, or I don't know if I'd written it, but I remembered as a reporter in covering when the Kennedys got off the plane at Love Field. I recall that there was I can't remember whether it was a slight blue stripe in President Kennedy's dress shirt. And what it turned out, it was a red stripe. Now, that's a tiny thing. But I wrote, or I think I told the rewrite man, that it was a blue stripe. And then I always thought it was a blue stripe. But it turned out, because I saw a photograph of the shirt, from the autopsy. It was taken after he died at Bethesda Naval Hospital. So many years later, I'm looking through the stuff getting ready for that. I thought, my God, that was wrong. And I had it wrong all these years. And there were other little things. Most of the big things, yes, I did have right. But even the story that I told many times about with the Secret Service agent and taking the bubble top down, my recollection of what happened in the police station. I'm not so sure the more I think about it. When the Secret Service agent came to me afterwards and said, "Oh, my God, Jim, if I just hadn't taken the bubble top down." My recollection is there were tears in his eyes. But I'm not so sure of that now. I'm not sure. I may have imagined there were tears. I may have thought there should have been tears in his eyes. I don't know. I may have brought my own tears in my eyes. Maybe they were in my eyes. I don't know.
Yeah.
And humility is the number one trait a good reporter must always have. Is you report a story at a given moment, and that moment changes. And what you saw may change because based on what somebody else told you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's very confusing. It's not confusing, but as I say, if you're humble about it and you don't play games and you tell people what you're doing, what the process is, and admit that things change, you'll be fine.
I was at a dinner that you spoke at a few nights ago, and you were talking to Lee Cullum up on stage, and you said something that really struck me. In fact, forgive me for whipping out my phone and tweeting this, but
sure.
I did immediately. You said, the more you know about things, the less opinionated you can be about anything.
Absolutely.
And that seems to fly in the face of the way a lot of television information programming is done these days.
I know. No, here again, that was something I learned very early on here in Dallas as a reporter. You go into a story, any given story, and the city editor or somebody, or executive producer, whatever kind of organization you work for, somebody assigns you to cover a story. Now, here's the deal here. You know, we've got a shooting in South Dallas, and it looks like it's a murder or whatever. And so you go down there to cover it, and you assume with the idea that it's a murder. Well, then if you've got to immediately put that aside, and you've got to say, no, wait a minute. Let me, you know, what a good detective does, what a good police officer does, a good law enforcement officer does when investigating a crime. Well, a reporter's got to do exactly the same thing. And the kinds of assumptions that people make can damage forever the end result, because if you come across some information that flies in the face of what your assumption is or what the premise that on which you did that you went up this. I mean, the hardest thing in the world for a reporter to do is to have a premise for a story and then start really working on it and realize that it was wrong and the original premise was wrong. And when you get into covering politics, you really, really come across people who have very strong views about things. You realize they don't know anything about this. They only know one thing, and they stuck on it, and that's where my feeling comes, is the more you know about something, the less opinionated you are about it.
Jim Lehrer is my guest. His new novel is called Top Down. Forgive me, I was supposed to take a break about 3 minutes ago to start fundraising, and I got so wrapped up in the conversation that I forgot to do so. We want to remind you that we are in our fall fundraising campaign. The number you can call to support quality journalism here at KERA is 888-694-6931. You can also go online and make your contribution at KERA.org. If you have not yet got your copy of Jim Lehrer's new novel, Top Down, we do have thank you gifts available with a contribution of $10 a month, $120 a year. You can set that up within a matter of seconds when you go online to KERA.org or when you call 888-694-6931. KERA is the only news radio station in town where you will receive substantive, hour-long interviews with people who really matter, who have interesting perspectives on the world, and who will always be respected. So give us a call now, 888-694-6931. Or go online to KERA.org. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Arts program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in Global Studies, Human Rights, Creative Writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Jim Lehrer, longtime anchor and executive editor of the PBS NewsHour and author of the brand new novel Top Down. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So this novel takes off actually 5 years after the assassination. That's where you start us. And I guess at that point, were people in fact already doing Where Were You Then conferences?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely they were. And they've been doing them every year since. Mm-hmm. I mean, where it's not just a journalism thing. It's where everybody remembers that. It was the first national tragedy that touched everybody. And it never occurred to most people. Including me, that anybody would ever shoot a president of the United States. So sure, Abraham Lincoln. We knew about Abraham Lincoln, and we knew about Garfield, and we knew about McKinley and all of that. But that was long before modern times. And the assassination of John F. Kennedy, also because he was, say, the young, vibrant president, and he had this young, vibrant wife and family. And for him to be shot down, it was just a traumatic event for every American. And as a consequence, people talk to this day, who are still alive. Obviously, they have to be alive and still be talking about it. But they remember exactly where they were, mm-hmm. and they always have, and they go into minute detail. I was sitting in the bus and somebody came in and hollered this or whatever. Or I was in school and they came and said this and we did that. And you know, I had just walked into a store. Oh, and they know the name. Remember the name of the store, what they were buying, what everybody said and did, and how everybody kind of suddenly comforted each other with it. I couldn't believe it. First of all the kind of stuff. It is an ongoing event, and it always will be. For everybody who was alive on November 22nd, 1963.
You had an essay this weekend in Points in the Dallas Morning News in which you talked about the way the assassination really changed the role of television for delivering particularly sort of emergency news, breaking news. You were a print guy at the time the assassination happened. How long did it take for you to realize that there was something to this other medium that maybe before had been kind of late to the game rather than the first ones there?
Well, it was late to the game for a lot of obvious reasons. First of all, the technology wasn't there yet. But there were a lot of print people had the attitude that I had, which was an attitude of arrogance.
Yahoos
to be on television is kind of beneath me. I'm a serious journalist, meaning I write things and they're printed. I don't talk into a microphone or smile into a camera, and so I was just as bad as everybody else was. But what the Kennedy assassination did suddenly. The softness, as I called it in this piece you're talking about in the Dallas Morning News the other day, was of television news went through an instant transformation, and that event was the beginning of television news being a serious vehicle for people not only to find out what the news was, but to see it, but also to share it. It was much more difficult to share. Let's say we woke up every morning and read the Dallas Morning News in Dallas. Well, we could share that news, mm-hmm. and that was a shared experience. But it's different because here again, you read it. Everybody reads it differently and whatever. Well, the same. It also happens later in television. But when television news came into its own was with the Kennedy assassination, in my opinion, because that's when actually it was my wife, Kate, who really, when I was thinking about all of this and writing this piece for the Dallas News, she said, you know, you haven't made the point about how this transformed television news. And she was absolutely right. I gave it a lot of thought, thanks to her. And I realized that that was a shared experience. We all sat around. All over the country, anybody who had a television or access to a television, most people didn't have televisions. The overwhelming majority of Americans did not have television sets in 1963. But an overwhelming majority had access to one, mm-hmm. down the street or in the barbershop or in a restaurant or in a bar or whatever. And we all mourned together. We all expressed disbelief together. And when I say we, I mean we, the American people, could not. And the whole apparatus of network television news just matured overnight. And it became the vehicle. And then as other tragedies came along, it was there. It was there as, on a daily basis to cover regular, quote, regular news. But it was also there to cover special, tragic events that we needed to participate in as observers, and that's hard to do in print, but with print alone. I mean, then it's all mostly a vehicle of word of mouth and a vehicle of your own thinking. But television made it all visible and vocal and oral and in ways that kind of captured you inside as well as outside.
Of course, you open Pandora's box and suddenly you usher in this era, I shouldn't say suddenly, but over the years where there's this constant pressure on television journalists in particular, and now print journalists, because we have everything online, to constantly be updating with new facts, even when new information does not exist, can't be verified. I suppose good things came of that and bad things came of that.
Absolutely right. The other night here in Dallas, I had dinner with two old friends who are journalists, reporters, now retired. Bob Compton, who was longtime book editor and before that assistant city editor and many things at the Dallas Morning News, and Darwin Payne, who I worked with at the Times Herald, had all kinds of various jobs as a reporter and then as an editor at the Dallas Times Herald, and then, of course, taught journalism at SMU for many years and written many books about Dallas. And I told him the story about I was at the police station the night of November 22nd, the day of November 22nd, 1963, after the assassination. And it was a chaotic place. And everybody, there were all kinds of law enforcement people, and there were all kinds of reporters around. And we were all trying to find out what had happened. And a FBI agent told me in the hallway that, oh, my God, not only was Kennedy shot and killed, but Conley was shot, and also a Secret Service agent was killed. So I immediately go to the telephone and call the rewrite desk of the Times Herald, my newspaper, was a few blocks away, and I said, I've just heard from the FBI that a Secret Service agent was killed, too. Well, that was the first time that information had come. Well, within an hour or so, the other people and I, with my assistants, we were able to confirm that that was not true.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in today, we were talking about these with Bob and Darwin and I were talking about this last night. In the today's world of journalism, that piece of false information that I had given would have been all over the world by now. And because somebody would have called that in, and it would have gone to somebody's website, you know, boom, boom, boom. Because the print versions the online versions of print vehicles, of newspapers, are now as competitive as bulletins used to be on the wire service, used to be on the radio. And that thing would have gone all over the world. And as you say, there are many downsides to this incredible revolution we have in information, electronic and otherwise. And we just have to keep in mind that there's also a good side to it. And the good side, you have to kind of remind yourself, and we have to use the good side, which is there's a lot more information available than there's ever been before. In the old days, you'd have your daily newspapers, you'd have the three commercial television network news programs. That would be about it, unless you wanted to skim read Time or Newsweek. That was it. And everybody pretty much read the same things, and we all had that shared information. Now there are hundreds of thousands of outlets, of sources, of reactions to reactions and responses to responses and all. It all comes within a matter of minutes. And everybody wants to be first, but not everybody cares whether or not they're right.
Hmm.
And so the consumer of news must be more careful than ever before, because it does not have that time, that automatic. There was a deadline It took time to gather, if you were in print, it took time to gather the story. The story had to be edited. It had to be set in type. It had to be, and hours went by from the time you knew something to the time you actually read it. And it was those times, and in television, took time to develop film and all that sort of stuff. Well, now everything just goes boom, 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 boom. And a couple of those booms, in between the boom and the other boom, you can get some false information, and we always have to be careful.
I've always wanted to ask you about this. About 10 years ago, I put together a documentary about the assassination. You were featured in it. We had Bob Schieffer. We had a number of different people who were directly involved. And one of the most interesting things for me was going through what was essentially cutting room floor stuff, the background, the things that never made air that were taken from within the Dallas police station. And if you look carefully, you can spot Peter Jennings. You can spot a number of people who went on to very distinguished careers, including Robert McNeil. You guys didn't know each other at all then.
We didn't know each other. He was working for NBC, and he was at Love Field. He was on the press bus, and he was the second White House correspondent for NBC. In other words, there were two White House correspondents. There was Sander Van Oker was the lead one, and Robin was the second. And Sandy was on another trip with the Secretary of State Dean Rusk or whatever. So Robin was assigned to the Texas trip. He was on the press bus, and he came and he got off the press plane at Love Field, and he came down the same rope line with the pool that I was, where I was standing as a reporter for the Dallas Times here. We've looked, some people are still looking to find a photograph that has both of us in it, but they must exist, but we haven't found one yet. But we didn't know each other at the time, and he stayed on that story for a long time. I stayed on that story for a long time, and our paths never crossed. Of course, as I say to him, of course, you were a big network correspondent. I was just a little dodo local newspaper man. You didn't have time to talk to me. And oh, no, 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 no. But we've become close friends since.
Jim Lehrer is my guest. He's the longtime anchor and executive editor of the PBS NewsHour and author of the new novel, Top Down. We'll come back to our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or call in to 1-800-933-5372. Executive producer Jeff Whittington is here now to talk about ways to support this kind of quality journalism, this kind of interesting conversation that we're able to bring you because of your dollars.
Yeah, hey, Chris, what an honor and a pleasure to have Jim Lehrer in studio again here for Think. And during this time, just want to mention Jim's in town to help us launch the Jim Lehrer Roundtable for KERA. He's also here for a symposium for Dallas at the Dallas Institute, KERA, the Morning News, the Sixth Floor Museum, a couple of other organizations, the Ockberg Society, the Mayborn Institute up at UNT is having this coming Saturday. And of course, there's information about that online at kera.org. But it comes back to the conversation. I mean, every single day, 4 days a week, Chris, you're in here for 2 hours. You talk to some of the most amazing guests that we wouldn't be able to get if we didn't have the support of listeners, people who help us pay the bills here. Our recent news expansion is happening thanks to the support of people who have contributed to KERA. Our ability to turn the lights on, our ability to staple some papers together. I mean, it's from the biggest high-thinking concepts to the lowliest, smallest, most basic things that a business has to do are only possible because people call 888-694-6931. They're only possible because you go online to kera.org and give some money to the radio station.
We're not selling you to advertisers in the way that some news organizations do. And I don't want to sound too cynical about that because they're doing very good work. They're just working on a different business model. But we come directly to you and explain the expenses we have, explain our plans for serving this community with local news, and also bringing you national and international news that I think is unparalleled, really, in this market on the broadcast dial. If you want that kind of news and information, you come to KERA. We're here all the time. We want to be here for those of you who couldn't possibly make a contribution, but a lot of us, if you really think about it, can afford to chip in $5 or $10 or $20 a month without really even missing the money. But that contribution makes you a real patron of quality news and information. We all talk about how important it is that we have these sources of information. Sometimes making things happen starts with taking action. And this is a relatively small action, but one that we know that you'll feel good about. 888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go to KERA.org and get a copy of Jim Lehrer's new novel, Top Down.
Yeah, it's available at the $120 membership level with our thanks. The book's been out. It's received great reviews. You may have heard Jim interviewed in a number of places. We're really thrilled and honored to have him here today. And we're really excited to be able to offer you a copy of the book. When you join the station today, it's a $10 a month membership level. And you know what? That's about the average gift for KERA listeners. It's about $10 a month is what we normally get from people who support the station. So it's right in line with that. And we're really excited to be able to offer that. And you can check it out online at kera.org or call 888-694-6931.
Let me underline that pitch, if I may.
Please.
Please do.
You can underline it better than we ever could.
Well, I've been in public broadcasting. I started at KERA in 1970, and I've been in public broadcasting ever since. And one of the things I have never, ever, ever complained about and never, ever thought second, I mean, ever had any kinds of qualms about is what you all are doing, which is soliciting the listeners or the viewers of public broadcasting entities, KERA Radio, in this case, but also KERA TV, or it could be Wawa this and or whatever it is. It could be the News Hour, whatever. Because the important thing is that it's the individuals who watch and listen and support us are the individuals who give us the independence to practice the kind of journalism we want to practice. And I agree with what you say, Chris. It isn't that the other people are evil or whatever, that the commercial world, quite the contrary. It's just that when you open the microphone here at KERA Radio, you open it with your professional principles, your only guiding principles. And there's nothing else, nothing is seeping around the edges or whatever. And you are free in journalism if you don't have the independence to be wrong. If you don't have the freedom to be wrong, you'll seldom be right because you'll be running scared all the time. And what's so wonderful here is that we of public broadcasting are beholden to the people we actually serve. And it is, I would urge anybody who is a regular listener of KERA to think about it and realize that what you're doing by listening to KERA is you are getting free you're getting a free independent news source that is unlike any other, and if you value it, then there's a way to show how much you value it.
888-694-6931 is the way to show that. You can also go online at kera.org. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Jim Lehrer.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Arts program, accepting applications for this January to design your own Master's of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, human rights, creative writing, and others. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Jim Lehrer, who was longtime anchor and executive editor of the PBS NewsHour and has a new novel out, his 21st, called Top Down. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So the New York Times said a couple of weeks ago that you are talking to WETA about selling off your ownership of the NewsHour. Can you talk a little bit about that decision?
We're not selling it. We're actually donating.
Forgive me.
The Liberty Media And Robert McNeil and I are the partners who own McNeil Air Productions, which is for 20 years we've produced this company has produced the NewsHour in partnership with WETA, which is the public television station in Washington, D.C., with some help from WNET in New York, which is a public television station in New York. And Robert McNeil is out of the not involved in the nightly program anymore. I'm less and less involved in the nightly program. The way the whole company was set up is the editorial control, administrative control of the organization is in the hands specifically of Robert McNeil and Jim Lehrer, it says. Mm-hmm. And so we realize we need to protect the long-term future of this organization. Not because it was in jeopardy, but because it just needed to be in the control of an organization, a public broadcasting organization number one, but a nonprofit organization number two, and one that was completely nonprofit at least, that one that was that that had a history of editorial excellence, et cetera, and WETA was it. So what we have done, what Liberty and Robin and I are doing or in the process of doing is contributing the company to WETA. McNeil and I will continue to function as consultants in some form or fashion as yet to be decided. But that's what it's all about. It's something that had to be done, and we're delighted to do it. But it's kind of sad for us, McNeil Lehrer has been a trade name, and our little company may still exist in a different form, but it will not have anything to do with the NewsHour, and so that's what it's all about.
Does your relationship to breaking news change now that you don't have an immediate daily responsibility to sort of comprehend that and package it and process it for a group of viewers?
Oh, it's a good question, Chris. I'm still as interested as I ever was. It is in some ways a relief, sometimes a frustration, that I don't have to deal with that news. Mm-hmm. Because daily journalism, including my print time, I've been doing it for 50 years. And you could say, oh, my goodness, that isn't that an awful, awful, awful thing? No, 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 that's a delightful thing. A daily deadline is a very mind-focusing event in one's daily life. And when 6 o'clock Eastern time comes, we have to have a program ready. And I have to be able, for all these years, I had to be able to say good evening. And not say, hey, sorry, we're not quite ready yet. and anyhow, it's a focusing thing. It was also a very accomplishing thing, accomplishment thing. I mean, when the day ended, both back when I was in print and since when I've been in television, I could say, well, I did this today. And it had a beginning, a middle, and an end. And there's not a thing in the world I can do if I made a mistake today, I have to fix it tomorrow. Mm-hmm. But I don't have to fix it tonight. I can't.
Right.
It's done. And the deadline is, as I say, a very concentrating thing. And so what I do now, since I've stepped aside on the daily part, I just make up my own deadline. I still have to have deadlines. Mm-hmm. And for my writing, and I've done a lot of writing, even more writing, obviously, since I left the Daily Show. But I come up with my own deadlines. I'm going to have this done by Friday and, a week from Friday and all of a sudden. I always do that because that is just the way I am now. See, some people can't handle deadlines. It just drives people nuts. Mm-hmm. There are some people for whom a deadline is a guidepost of life, and I think that's for me. I mean, that's the way it's always been for me. Robert McNeil's the same way. His only difference is he would have a deadline. Let's say he had 12 minutes to get something done. He would start it 12 minutes before. I would start maybe an hour and 12 minutes before in order to make the deadline. But it is, as I say, a concentrating thing, and I miss it. And yet I don't miss it completely, because what it does now, it gives me the time to think between deadlines and take some deep breaths between events, between finishing a play or finishing a novel or making a speech or whatever in the world I'm doing at any given time. And I am delighted about that. So it was my decision to step aside from the NewsHour. I wanted to step aside when I was still able to do things, and do things that mattered, and didn't feel like I'd lost a step yet, and I wanted to leave the daily journalism thing before I'd left a step, mm-hmm. Lost a step, and so I think I have, and I feel good about it.
Your character in this novel, your protagonist, Jack Gilmore, bears a lot of resemblance to a young Jim Lehrer. Mm. He dreams of just being a novelist. Was that something that you thought about a lot when you were younger?
Absolutely. That was my dream. Mm-hmm. And, I'm from the Hemingway. You and I have talked about that before, but I'm from the Hemingway generation. Hemingway said, you want to be a writer, get a job on a newspaper. Force you to deal with the English language in some semi-coherent way every day. You'll meet all kinds of interesting people that you can later use as characters and see in various events you can use in novels or plays and whatever. And also it keeps bread on the table while you're – and so I bought into all of that. So I went into journalism not so much to cover the news as much as to be a writer. And so writing was always in the forefront of my, quote, ambitions, and it was always part of it. In fact, when I first started at the Dallas Morning News and later at the Times Herald, the reporters, my friends, we competed not over who could get the greatest story but who could write the best and who wrote the best leads and all of that. Writing was a premium, and writing was what it was all about for me, and it still is.
Do you think that young journalists getting into the business recognize the importance of good writing in the same way?
No, I don't. And I think that's a shame. I think it's not just journalists, but I think everybody should learn to write. Because no matter what it is that you're going to end up doing, the person who can write well is always going to have a leg up on people who can't. Because the ability to write a coherent sentence, a declarative sentence that people can understand, is a huge advantage over you gives you a huge advantage over people who cannot do that. I had a friend who was a journalist who decided he wanted to be a lawyer, and he went to law school. And I said, "How you doing?" He was at the University of Illinois. I caught him on the phone. I said, "How's law school?" He said, "Oh, it's a snap." And I said, "Hey, I thought it was supposed to be difficult." "Well, it is for everybody else, but it isn't for me because I'm used to reading things and distilling them and writing them down in a clarifying way. And that's what I learned because I'm a journalist." And so it doesn't matter what you do ultimately as a profession, as a vocation, if you can write a coherent sentence in a way that people understand what you're talking about is extremely important. And there's very, very few things that are more important in terms of the education process that I believe for everybody, but obviously for journalists. I mean, a journalist, you can have the greatest story in the world, but if you can't write it and present it in such a way that people get it and understand it and get the gist of what it is you're trying to get there, so you're not going to be a successful journalist.
Have you kept all your reporters' notebooks over the years?
No, I haven't, unfortunately. I kept the one from November 22nd, 1963. Now I can't find it, but that's neither here nor there. I kept a lot of them. Maybe they're somewhere. They're just so
garage
much stuff.
Or,
yeah. They're just so much stuff and Kate's in my life. Lives together, and we have boxes and boxes of it. I just haven't gotten around to going through them yet.
Well, I have to ask you what relaxation looks like for you, because I imagine you saying, "Great, I pulled back from the NewsHour. I'll just write two novels a year and a play and, you know, crank out 5 miles a day on the track." I mean, how do you unwind?
Well, fortunately, we have 3 grown daughters and 6 grandchildren, and they all live close to us in New York. We live in Washington, but they live in New York. But it's all everybody, most of them, with the exception of one of the grandchildren, they all live in the New York area. And I now have more time to deal to play, mm-hmm. Spend those extra 3 days to do this and that and the other thing, and to spend time with the kids but also with friends and all of that. And it's I've never been a big traveler. I'm the worst tourist in the world. So I'm not, you know, oh my God, now we can go to the pyramids and all that. I mean, Kate's more keen on that than I am, and there's been some compromising on all of that. because I've always been able to use my daily job to keep from having to do a lot of things. And she said, well, wait a minute now. We can do this. You can do this and all that. So we're you know, there's been some adjustment, but fortunately there's not been any serious problems.
Well, Jim Lehrer, it's always such a pleasure and such an honor to have you in. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Chris, there will always be time to talk to you. I will always have time to talk to you in KERA radio. This is my home, and you are my friend, and this is my place to be.
Well, thank you so much. Jim Lehrer's new novel is called Top Down. You know him, of course, as a longtime anchor and executive editor of the PBS NewsHour. We were able to bring you this conversation with Jim Lehrer thanks to the generosity of people just like you, listeners, who have really taken the station seriously and recognized the importance of quality journalism, of in-depth conversations. We cannot thank you enough for making this possible. And if you haven't joined the station in the past, or if you have not made a contribution in over a year, think about getting online now at kera.org or calling in to 888-694-6931. Jeff Whittington is here now. Jeff, I'm a little flustered with those kind words from Jim Lehrer.
Well, I was going to stretch it out and offer Jim Lehrer's friendship to everyone listening and contributing as well, because I'll bet Jim would consider those of you who support KERA and those of you who do your part to help maintain this, which it's really becoming a pretty venerable institution. I mean, KERA Radio next summer is going to celebrate its 40th anniversary. KERA Television, where Jim Lehrer got his start in broadcasting in 1970, it celebrated its 50th anniversary a few years ago. So, you know, I think Jim, and Jim's lent his name to our new Jim Lehrer Roundtable, mm-hmm. which is a donor level at the $10,000 annual or above level. And, you know, of course, that level's open to you today, as is the $10 a month level, which we can thank you with your very own copy of Top Down, Jim Lehrer's new novel of the Kennedy assassination.
We want to thank all of you who are making contributions this hour, including Walter Thomas in Irving, Francois Decote in Denton, Mickey Tryon in Arlington, Christina Dunmore in Decatur, and Charles Hess in Dallas. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much for calling 888-694-6931. Or for going online to kera.org and supporting the station, supporting this show, the show that brings you conversations with people like Jim Lehrer. What a fantastic conversation. I mean, he's just got such great things to say about journalism.
And such a clear-headed view.
Yeah. Well, you know, it comes with, when you think about it, a lot of the stuff that we just take as a matter of course, and maybe you do too as a KERA listener, as a public radio supporter and consumer. Well, Jim Lehrer was in the room when they made the decision about how things were going to be. Jim Lehrer had a role in deciding, in inventing, really, the public broadcasting journalism, you know, the rules for how public broadcasting journalists would do their jobs. And it's a real pleasure to be able to hear from him. And he is always very generous with his time. And, you know, Jim's in town this week, and he's appearing at the symposium on Saturday. It's the JFK, the 50th anniversary symposium for Dallas, sponsored by KERA, the Dallas Morning News, the Dallas Institute of Humanities and Culture, the Sixth Floor Museum, the Ochberg Society, of which Jim is a board member, and the Mayborn Journalism School at University of North Texas. That's taking place this Saturday. You can find out about that on KERA.org when you go there to make your contribution.
888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go to KERA.org. You know, Jim Lehrer is a great example of, I think, one of the values of public broadcasting journalism, which is humility. You know, the idea that this guy who was there the weekend of the assassination decided to write a book, which is a fictionalized account, but he wanted the factual stuff to be so correct that he went back and did research on things that he had witnessed himself. That to me is a commitment to accuracy, and it is also an understanding that no one is perfect, and that sort of desire to get it as right as possible. That, I mean, I'm just proud to have met him, and I'm certainly proud that he is associated with public broadcasting and public broadcasting journalism. You can support this kind of journalism at 888-694-6931.
We're thrilled that he's associated with KERA.
Yes.
We'd like for you to be associated with KERA, too, because we've heard from many of you. We're nearly halfway to the goal for this membership campaign. So do your part right now. Do it at KERA.org or call 888-694-6931.
Thanks.